WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Levon Helm became famous as the drummer in the group The Band. He sang lead on The Wait. He recently released his first solo album in 25 years. It features traditional songs and new songs inspired by them. On today's Fresh Air, Levon Helm talks about returning to singing after cancer in his vocal cords. Also, we listen back to an interview with novelist Jane Rule. She died late last month at the age of 76. Her first novel, Desert of the Heart, was considered a landmark work of lesbian fiction and was made into a film in 1985. And TV critic David Bianculli has some suggestions for the television viewers on your holiday gift list, everything from silly to serious to classic DVDs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Levon Helm, was the drummer in the group The Band. This is the group that backed Bob Dylan after he went electric and went on to become famous in their own right after the release of their 1968 album, Music from Big Pink, which featured Helm singing lead on The Wait. Recently, Helm released his first solo album in 25 years. It's called Dirt Farmer, and it features traditional songs and contemporary songs in that style. The Washington Post Review described it as, quote, an exquisitely unvarnished monument to Americana from a man whose keening lyrical vocals have become synonymous with it, unquote. It's remarkable that his singing is this good after being diagnosed with cancer in his vocal cords in 1998. He was able to start singing again in 2004. For the past 4 years, he's presided over what he calls his midnight rambles, intimate concerts with his famous and not-so-famous friends at the barn that's become his home recording studio in Woodstock, New York. Let's start with the opening track of Dirt Farmer. That's Levon Helm from his new CD, Dirt Farmer. Levon Helm, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, I wasn't sure what to expect when I put your CD on because I knew about your vocal cancer. And your singing is so great on this, and it's so full out. And I'm wondering if the act of singing has changed for you, either technically or emotionally, since your recovery.
You know, it's a it's a lot more fun for me these days. I'm not quite as hard on myself as I used to be, and I still haven't fallen in love with the sound of my voice, but I am able to get some satisfaction when we try and do these tunes, and it takes me a little while sometimes, but it's an interesting process.
What state is your voice in physically now? I said recovery. Are you in a full recovery, a partial recovery? Where are you?
Well, I think I'm in a full recovery. My voice don't sound a whole lot better than it did before I had cancer, but I had a period of time there for about 2.5 years or so where I had to just kind of whisper or either write you a note and tell you what I wanted you to know. And of course it, there's nothing I can do except just be the drummer, which is my main ambition anyway, but it sure is a whole lot, a lot brighter of a future now that I can sing my part and help out with some of the lead vocals.
Was it a lonely period when you couldn't talk?
It sure was. It was real lonesome.
So I know that your doctor, your first doctor told you that he'd perform surgery and you'd need a voice box, but after the second opinion, you went with radiation treatments instead, which seemed to be effective in stopping the cancer. But were you able to imagine life with a voice box?
I couldn't. It was just a horrible thing, to face since then. I have friends, of course, that have faced it and have conquered it. So it's it's just one of those burdens that some of us have to bear. My saving grace was to run into Dr. Kraus down at Sloan Kettering in New York, and they certainly saved my bacon.
Let's hear another song from your new CD, Dirt Farmer. And I want to play The Blind Child. I really love your recording of this. I wasn't familiar with the song before. How do you know the song?
Oh, that's one of those old back porch songs that my dad and my mom and my aunts and uncles used to sing and play for each other. Those were Blind Child and Little Birds and The Girl I Left Behind. Those were some of the first songs that we started with. Those were the original working title was Songs from Home.
Well, let's hear Blind Child, and this is from Levon Helm's new CD, Dirt Farmer.
They tell me, Father, that tonight you'll wed another bride, that you will clasp her in your arms where my dear mother died. They say her name is Mary. So soft and light, her voice so meek and mild. And tell me, Father, will she love your blind and helpless child? Picture is resting on the shelf. Her books are lying here, and as they harp, her fingers touched, there's her vacant chair, the chair whereby her side I knelt to say clothes, need this little dark curly hair, and the very last words that the blind child spoke, there'll be no blind ones there. No, the very last words that the blind child spoke, there'll be no blind ones there.
That's Blind Child from Levon Helm's new album, Dirt Farmer. You said you learned this song as a child. Did the song scare you as a child because it's about a child who's blind and whose mother's died? And it's a really tragic song.
Yes, it is. It's one of those story songs, a true-to-life kind of a song. And those were the songs that people really went for back then. Anything else was suspect. It could be something that somebody just made up, you know, with no real bearing to it. So songs like that were the ones that had lasted and stood the test of time when my folks came along.
You know, I'm interested in the fact that you've done an album of largely traditional songs and more contemporary songs written in the manner of traditional songs. You know, I listened back to our 1993 interview a few days ago, and I had quoted to you something in your memoir, which was published in 93, and you had said that you were reluctant to record with Dylan initially because you thought Dylan was too folky. And in the interview, you said we, meaning your band at the time, the Hawks, we were more into R&B and blues music. We weren't big folk fans. We liked horns, rhythm sections. We liked the full house on the bandstand. And Bob Dylan was coming from more of a troubadour kind of place, just him and his guitar. What happened between then and now to change your mind about recording folk music?
Well, it sounds like we all got religion, don't it? Yeah, you know, what I meant to say, I guess, is I still kind of feel that way. I'm a drummer, and Bob was a strummer without a drummer when we first ran into each other. So, you know, I'm just not drawn to songs that don't involve a set of drums and a full rhythm section.
Now, the song we just heard, The Blind Child, doesn't involve drums in a full rhythm section, but the first song that we heard, False Hearted Lover, the drumming's great on it, and it's almost like somewhere between rock and a march that you're playing.
Yeah.
So do you feel like you transform certain traditional folk songs by putting your beat behind them?
Well, I think I've made it a little bit easier in spots, maybe a little more danceable.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully I've made it, easier for people from my school, the Full House Rhythm Section School, to hear.
My guest is Levon Helm. He's speaking to us from his studio in Woodstock, New York. The sound you may hear in the background is his dog shaking its collar. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Levon Helm. His new CD is called Dirt Farmer. Since 2006, you've been doing midnight rambles.
Yeah.
At your home and studio.
Uh-huh.
And these are just, you describe what they are.
Well, they're basically music parties. We have, you know, two, three, sometimes one a week, at least two or three a month, and we have them on Saturday nights in Woodstock at the studio. And it started out as basically a modern version of the old-fashioned rent party. But since then, the musicians that have taken part in it have really raised it to another level. And I guess it's 3 years, going on 4 years later now, and we have people that are coming in from all over the place to celebrate with us. That includes the players, too.
Did you need it as a rent party? Because I know after you got sick, you had to declare bankruptcy.
This is true. Well, it started off as a rent party, so to speak. It looked like the studio was going to be put on the blocks because I was in pretty rough shape financially. And just as I started to kind of get my voice back and I was able to work a little more, is when we tried the Midnight Ramble. And it paid the rent, so we basically kept it up. And now this much later, it's really turned into a benefit for a lot of the players.
Now, you named the Midnight Ramble after concerts that you saw as a child growing up in Arkansas. Describe the Midnight Rambles that yours are named after.
Well, there used to be one of my favorite traveling tent shows at the time was an outfit called, it was called the F.S. Walcott's Original Rabbit's Foot Minstrels. And this was a big five-polar tent that they set up. And they parked two of the big tractor-trailer flatbeds side to side to make the stage, put the tent around that, and they had a chorus line, a band, a troupe of singers, dancers, and players, and they would put on in these small towns through the South. They would play every week, and you would go to the midnight. You would go to the concert. At the end of the concert, which would be over around 10:30, 11, they would offer a midnight ramble ticket. And for the people who could stay up late, all the kids were supposed to go home and get ready for school or Sunday school. And the grown-ups could stay and buy an extra ticket and get an extra half hour, 45 minutes of music and spicy or jokes. And one of the prettiest girls in the chorus line would do a little hoochie-coochie, and what a show.
Well, there's no like hoochie-coochie in your Midnight Ramble, is there?
You know, we've almost had it break out a couple of times. Amy and Larry Campbell's mom the other night jumped up and started doing a little hoochie-coochie.
Now, getting back to the Midnight Rambles, which are kind of like house parties, but on a very elevated level, you write in your memoir that your father used to perform weekends at house parties.
Oh, yeah.
Did he tell you stories about that, or were you old enough to go to any of them when he was still doing it?
Well, you know, by the time that I got old enough to go, televisions were just starting to come out. And we didn't get electricity and didn't have one yet, but the trend was started towards couch potato and... You know, just the participation generation was going by the wayside. And I didn't have a chance to play many of those house parties. I got to go to a few as a young kid. I remember one night they had one at my uncle's house. And my Uncle Pudge, who also played guitar, and I had a big grocery box. Pasteboard box, and I beat that thing to death that night. I was I volunteered to play percussion. But that was the old, move the furniture out of the biggest room, and a guitar player, a fiddle player, and maybe a mandolin player was about the strength of the band.
After being used to playing big venues, was it unnerving at first to play in an intimate setting, you know, with much fewer members of the audience in your own studio?
You know, those big things, they're kind of a payoff in a way, I guess, but they're not very much fun. I've never been able to hear myself correctly in one of those situations, and it's basically like... sticking your head in a barrel and trying to perform. And you do the best you can, but some of the worst shows I've ever played has been in those big places.
Let me choose another song from the new CD. This is Single Girl, Married Girl, which I believe is another song that you grew up with.
Well, it's just another one of those songs. It's kind of in that same area there, and it gave me as a drummer another opportunity to kind of monkey up the beat of a traditional country rhythm.
So here it is from Levon Helm's new CD, Dirt Farmer.
1, 2, 3. She wears
That's Single Girl, Married Girl from Levon Helm's new CD, Dirt Farmer. There's such great harmonies on your CD, and your daughter, Amy, does most of the harmony singing on this.
Well, that's Amy and Teresa Williams, Larry Campbell's wife, and that's one of the great gifts from Dirt Farmer for me is the sound of Amy and Teresa's harmonies. We didn't know before Dirt Farmer that they would blend and sound the way they sound together.
I've asked this to other performers who have ended up performing with their adult children. But when your daughter was born, did you ever think, this is my future performing partner? She's just arrived.
No, I never did. I guess I had the same hopes for Amy that my parents had for me. I wanted Amy to be a scholar. You know, my parents wanted me to be smart and be a scholar, and the best I could do was graduate high school. And bless her heart, Amy, I got to say, she did finish school out at Wisconsin and made a beautiful picture of her in her graduating robe, and I'm so proud of her. But the same bug bit Amy that bit me, and she fell back in with the rhythm section as soon as she got out of school.
Levon Helm will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now exhibiting drawings by Georges Seurat. More at moma.org. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that more students graduate from high school ready for college, work, and citizenship. GatesFoundation.org. And from Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at breakthroughcollaborative.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli has some DVD gift suggestions. Also, we listen back to an interview with Jane Rule. She died late last month at the age of 76. Her novel, Desert of the Heart, is considered a landmark of lesbian fiction. And we continue our interview with Levon Helm. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Levon Helm. He was the drummer in the group The Band and sang lead on The Weight. In 1998, he was diagnosed with cancer in his vocal cords. His new CD, Dirt Farmer, is his recording comeback. He sings and plays drums. His daughter sings harmony and played a key part in getting the recording made. Now, you grew up singing with your family. Did you do a lot of tight harmonies at home?
A little bit. My mother and sister were so good at it that I stood around with my mouth open and listened for the most part.
So when you started to sing, if you were singing with your mother and her sister, did you say?
My mother and my older sister.
Your older sister. So you were used to female harmonies. So when you started doing harmonies with the band, Did you have to kind of transpose male and female parts in your mind?
Well, you know, you try to. It just, depends on how much, athletic ability you've got in your voice. I've always thought it was easier for girls to sing harmonies because their voices can go to that higher plane so much more easy than a male voice. And I'm not sure that they just don't sound sweeter and prettier.
Your father was a cotton farmer, but performed on weekends. What kind of songs would he do, the kinds of songs you've done on your new CD?
You know, he would probably have done, things like the up-tempo stuff that we do on Dirt Farmer. Some of those tunes he would have done. And I know one of the old songs, we didn't do it in this recording phase, but Settin' on Top of the World was an old favorite back then. You know, don't you come here running, holding out your hand. I've been your daddy, I've been your man, but now I'm gone and I ain't worried. I'm sitting on top of the world.
Yeah, and didn't Cream record that too? And of course, Bob Wills.
You know, I think they did, and
yeah.
I'm sure my dad, jumped the beat up like Cream did, to make it as danceable as possible.
Now, you performed with your sister when you were a teenager and won a lot of contests.
Yeah, my baby sister. Uh-huh.
This is your younger sister.
Yeah.
Okay. And you read in your memoir that, in those performances, you would play harmonica, jew's harp, and slap your thighs. Are there ever occasions that musically that call for thigh slapping now?
Well, that's the old ham bone trick. When I was coming through school, that was one of the things that you wanted to learn how to do was ham bone. And that's, how you slap your hand on your leg and your chest. Like, I don't know if you can hear it or not, but I... Like that. And it was just one of those things that you learned as a kid, in South Arkansas schools. And not knowing how to play guitar or anything, that was my first first reaction to music.
So you were doing that before you had a drum kit?
Yeah.
we've been talking about your music, but you've also been in a few films, including Coal Miner's Daughter, The Right Stuff, and most recently you were in The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada, which was directed by Tommy Lee Jones, who also starred in it. And you have a small but terrific part in it. And I want to play that scene. Tommy Lee Jones in the movie is going across the desert to bury his friend in the small town that his friend wanted to be buried in. So he's on this kind of like almost epic journey, taking the corpse, like dragging the corpse to the burial place. And he comes upon you, a blind man living alone in the middle of nowhere, and you make a very unusual request. Here's the scene.
I'd like to ask you a favor.
Anything you want.
I wanted to ask you,
if you can shoot me. My son ain't coming back. Oh, he'll come back.
No, he told me he had cancer. And he told me to go back to town with him. But I don't want to go, because I've always lived here.
Well, we can't do it.
I don't want to offend God by killing myself. It's a problem.
We don't want to offend God either.
It'd be the best thing to do. You're good people. You need to go ahead and shoot me.
What a great scene. What did you do to get into character? You play a blind man who I think is probably older than you are. You have scars and everything, around your eyes. So did you just kind of walk in and do it, or did you, prepare?
No, I'm just one of those guys that goes in and tries to do it. I don't know enough about it to prepare myself. I try and sleep as good as I can, and just enjoy it. I enjoy being with people who do know how to do that stuff. And I've never had anything but a good time around any of those shows that I've had the opportunity to be part of.
You know, your new CD is dedicated to your parents, and you perform on that CD with your daughter. Are you surprised now at the power of blood? And I ask that knowing that, like, you know, you left Arkansas at a pretty young age, and traveling around as a musician around the world, as you did with the band, I would imagine it would be easy to lose track of your family. But family in your early life and certainly now is so essential. I mean, the way you describe it, your daughter helped you survive. She took you to your radiation treatments in New York every week during the duration. She sings with you now. She co-produced the record. So I'm wondering if, like, you know, family ties have a different meaning to you than you thought they would have when you were, say, in your 20s or 30s.
They are stronger for me now. And I've always appreciated my family and friends, you know, and those ties that bind us together. But it's like my music, this much later and after you've almost got everything taken away from you. Once you get that back, boy, it's a joyful life that we've all been given. And, you know, you can really, you know, when you see a young nephew or a young person in your family that's blood related, and you see them for the first time, and they're not old enough to know that you're all related, but you can look into their face and they look into your eyes and you both know it. You know, we take it for granted, and you know, we enjoy that kind of thing without even a big thank you most of the time.
I want to close with another song from your new CD, and this is a Buddy and Julie Miller song called "Wide River to Cross." Can you talk about why you chose this song and why you chose it to end the CD?
Just, it's just such a great tune, and Buddy and Julie Miller are some of the best music makers that we've got. And I just love them for helping me do Dirt Farmer.
Well, this is a beautiful performance. Thank you so much for talking with us. And
Thank you, Terry, for calling. It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for playing the record.
We're really glad you're recording again and performing.
Oh, me too. Thank you,
honey. Thank you. Levon Helm's new CD is called Dirt Farmer.
There's a sorrow in the wind blowing down the road I've been. I can hear it cry while shadows steal the sun. But I cannot look back now. I've come too far to turn around. Still a race ahead that I must run. I'm only halfway home. I've got to journey on to where I'll find the thing I've lost. I have stumbled, I have strayed. You can trace the tracks I've made all across the memories my heart recalls. But I'm still a refugee. Won't you say sometimes even the strongest soldier falls. I'm only halfway home.
Coming up, we listen back to an interview with Jane Rule, the author of a classic work of lesbian fiction. She recently died at the age of 76. This is Fresh Air. In 1964, at a time when few writers dared to address the subject of homosexuality, Jane Rule published her first novel, Desert of the Heart. The main character was a woman who divorced her husband and fell in love with another woman. The book was adapted into the 1985 movie, Desert Hearts. Rule went on to publish other lesbian-themed novels, short stories, and essays. Sunday, we learned that she died late last month of complications from liver cancer. She was 76. We're going to listen back to an interview I recorded with her in 1988 after the publication of her novel Memory Board about two women in their 60s. I asked Rule if she was out among her friends and colleagues in 1964 when her novel Desert of the Heart was published.
Not officially. You have to remember that in those days you didn't talk about things like that. Certainly among my friends and my family I was, but I was teaching at the University of British Columbia at the time, and someone did bring up the issue after the book came out. And the defense in the department was, you don't have to be a murderer to write murder mysteries. And I think this is a very silly defensiveness, but in 1964, not surprising.
The stakes were really much higher then. There was no gay and lesbian movement. The stakes were much higher, I think, to admit to yourself or to anyone else that you were gay.
Well, it's not very hard to admit if you're in a very happy relationship. In fact, it's something to celebrate, so that it didn't seem to me anything humiliating, just awkwardly private. So that there were social problems about it. You know, we kept being invited to dinner parties with two gay men so that it would all look all right. And it was a totally open secret. But, I mean, you simply dealt in those terms in those days. I got much more restless much earlier than most people, I suppose, and then found myself the only open lesbian in Canada. And therefore, anytime an issue came up, I had to address it. So I became a kind of spokesperson for no movement, because there wasn't anybody else out there.
Well, how did you feel being thrust into that role?
Sometimes irritated. I don't really feel that my chief job is educating the world about lesbianism, or that it should be necessary, but obviously it is. And I think if you're put on the spot, the one thing you can do about it is to be educative as you can be.
Well, you once said that you hate labels that are used to describe writers. You know, women writer, feminist writer, lesbian writer. But if a label had to be applied to you, you'd like it to be Canadian writer. Why do you feel so strongly about that, and what got you to Canada?
Well, what got me to Canada was discovering Vancouver, which is one of the most beautiful cities in the world. And so it was actually the landscape. But also, I was looking for a way to get out of the United States. And you may not remember, but in the 1950s, McCarthy was requiring loyalty oaths and hunting down homosexuals all across the country and universities and the army. It was a very ugly, ugly time in the United States.
Although the movement, the feminist movement and the gay and lesbian movement, has had a lot of really positive effects for you, I think that one disadvantage that you've cited is the emphasis on political correctness, which you've always taken issue with.
In a sense, being a writer of fiction, I'm strongly opposed to fiction being used as propaganda for any reason. However, I think that if you present any characters, gay characters, positively, you're accused of propaganda, because the spoken and agreed on cliche is that all gay people are sick and miserable. But really, that one line that I must write all my characters to be perfect if they're gay that comes out of the gay movement is as silly. We aren't. We come in all different stripes, as everyone else does.
I would suspect that your readers write you very emotional letters. I'm thinking especially of readers who were first coming out as they started reading you, and it's so exciting to find characters in fiction whose lives reflect in some way your life, and gays have been so marginalized, especially in the past, in our culture, that it's just been impossible to find images of people who were gay. And if you find it, it can be so exciting. So I'm sure you've gotten very personal letters from readers who really wanted to make some kind of emotional contact with you. But it's really hard for an author to pay back emotionally, you know, in the same way that a reader would write in. How have you handled that?
I think it was most difficult for me when Desert of the Heart came out, because, of course, that was a little book out there all by itself without any other books for people to turn to. When you get a letter from a distressed reader or a reader who feels you're the only person in the whole world who understands them, there really isn't very much you can do. You know, when someone is writing you from South America saying they're about to kill themselves and only you can help, it's horrifying. And I think that it was the greatest burden to me after that book came out. I don't get as many distressed letters anymore. I get many more happy, celebrating letters, which are much easier to deal with.
When you were young, did you look for literature that had some evidence of homosexuality in it?
No, I read The Well of Loneliness when I was a kid and was horrified by it.
What horrified you?
Well, I thought, I'm going to have to live in a ghetto and dress up like a man. And I was already 6 feet tall with a deep voice, so, you know, it's just... And I couldn't speak French, and apparently the only people who knew each other were people who lived in Paris, and the whole thing just turned me off completely. And there was nothing else. But I didn't really look in literature for much of anything. I really, when I was a kid, thought that novels did an awful lot of lying about how people really felt. I didn't really understand that they were making social comments. I mean, I knew perfectly well that children didn't die so that we would be better people, as they do in Dickens, and I was very suspicious of literature, perhaps because I didn't find people or feelings that I could much identify with.
Well, then what made you want to write?
To tell the truth. Somebody had to.
Well, Jane Rule, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life and your writing.
Thank you. It's been a lovely interview.
Jane Rule recorded in 1988. She died November 27th at the age of 76. Coming up, our TV critic David Bianculli recommends DVDs that would make good holiday gifts. This is Fresh Air. If you don't know what to get a certain someone as a holiday gift, our TV critic David Bianculli suggests getting someone you love something they already love, television. Here are his suggestions for some TV series on DVD.
A few years ago, when I started suggesting certain DVD box sets as holiday gifts, there weren't all that many from which to choose. Now there are tons. So many that not even the most well-stocked video store or bookstore can carry them all. As the boxes get bigger and the inventory gets larger, it's a matter of shelf space. So if you can't find something I'm about to recommend at your local retail outlets, head to the internet. Let's start with the ultimate gift for all ages suggestion. BBC Video has put out a collector's set combining Planet Earth, the best nature documentary of the past few years, and The Blue Planet, the best one of the few years before that. Even for someone who watched and loved Planet Earth on the Discovery Channel, this gift will seem fresh, because this set preserves the original narration by Sir David Attenborough, not the one recorded for Discovery by Sigourney Weaver. There's a world of difference. And if you're buying for someone with all the latest technological goodies, this collector's set also comes in both high-definition formats. Either way, there's no one, from a little kid to a senior, who won't be absolutely enthralled by these programs. For little kids specifically, you've got the usual suspects, a new season of SpongeBob SquarePants, that sort of thing. But I'd like to suggest something that's not new, but that's relatively off the map and probably has to be ordered online. It's from BMG Video, and it's a movie-length cartoon originally made for ABC in 1970 called The Point. What's the point, you ask? You ask that a lot during my reviews, I suspect, but this time I won't take it personally. The Point is an animated fable written by Harry Nilsson, who also wrote the music. And even though this special will be 40 years old before too long, it still charms kids instantly and completely. I'm always road-testing my copy on young children, especially over the holidays, and they've always loved it. If you're old enough to remember the 70s, you may not have seen the TV show The Point, but I'm betting you remember the music.
Me and my arrow, straighter than narrow. Wherever we go, everyone knows it's me and my arrow.
Great music, great story, delightful animation. And, as a single disc, even Ebenezer Scrooge would consider it a bargain. Teenagers are tough to buy for, but if they're old enough to have seen and enjoyed Superbad or Knocked Up, I'd recommend getting two old TV series with similar sensibilities and lots of the same talent in front of and behind the screen. One is Freaks and Geeks, the other one is Undeclared, and they're both from Shout Factory. Or, if you dare, Comedy Central's Christmas Time in South Park is a good choice, too. College kids and 20-somethings? Always a tough demographic to buy for. But here are some ideas that should be almost foolproof. In the single-disc price range, there's a Best of the Colbert Report from Comedy Central that's loaded with great stuff. And since the writer's strike is keeping Stephen Colbert off the air right now, it's a double treat. There's a two-disc set, collecting the first season of HBO's Flight of the Conchords, that's also a very smart gift choice. And if you really want to spoil someone in his or her mid-20s, especially her mid-20s, get the six-disc complete collection of My So-Called Life from Shout Factory. Young women in their 20s now absolutely loved this series when they were in their mid-teens, the same age as Claire Danes, who starred as a mixed-up teenager. The set is new, the extras are wonderful, and the television show itself is superb. If you're shopping for someone in their 60s or above, I have three suggestions. Two silly, one serious. The serious one is the PBS Video box set of the new Ken Burns Lynn Novick documentary, The War, about World War II. On TV, it was fabulous. On DVD, when you can watch what and when you want, it's even better. The first silly suggestion is a new, almost ridiculously complete collection of Hopalong Cassidy from Infinity Entertainment, presenting all the TV shows and a lot more, featuring that oddly genteel but amazingly popular Western hero from television's early days. The second really silly one is a new collection of very old Spike Jonze TV appearances called Spike Jonze the Legend. The centerpieces are four live shows from the dawn of television featuring Spike as host. Two Colgate Comedy Hour shows from 1951, and two All-Star Review Hours from 1952. The visual quality is amazing, and the sound, well, the sound is pure Spike Jonze, which means it's totally insane.
Thank you.
Okay, that leaves baby boomers. There's an embarrassment of riches here, so I'll just mention the titles. The Complete Man from U.N.C.L.E. just came out, but you have to order it through the Time Life website. The first episodes of Route 66 just came out, too, from Infinity. My favorite set of the year may be the gold edition collection of Twin Peaks from CBS Paramount. And brand new this month on DVD are season 4 of The Wire from HBO and the second complete season of Saturday Night Live, the one introducing Bill Murray from Universal. And finally, on December 18th, come two last-minute holiday releases. One's another boomer treat, the first episodes of The Mod Squad from CBS. And the final treat for everyone is a movie from 20th Century Fox, but I feel justified ending this report on TV releases with it anyway. It's The Simpsons Movie, and it's as yummy as a frosted donut.
David Bianculli is TV critic and editor for TVWorthWatching.com. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Ian Chillog, Joan Tui Westman, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, and John Sheehan. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid talks about the latest developments in his country's upcoming election. Also, Marshall Herskovitz, the creator of 30-something and co-producer of My So-Called Life, talks about his new show and the writer's strike. Join us for the next Fresh Air.